The session in the ongoing series that we've been doing the last couple of weeks here, general subject is religious life in America today, or contemporary trends in American religious life. And this one is entitled New Rules for Religion. And I want to start with something of a commercial. Every so often in a given field, such as this one, or it could be in any of the other fields, a book comes along which is very perceptive and suddenly helps us understand some major changes or trends that have been going on, which we sort of suspected but weren't really sure we understood, or the book might help us see some old questions and some old issues in a new light. Some of these, just by way of review, I mean, if, for myself, if nothing else, would be David Reisman's book, The Lonely Crowd in 1950, or a book that created a great deal of attention in 1978-79, Christopher Lash's book, The Culture of Narcissism. Which is still very much worth reading, and still, in a way, within the same realm or scope of what we're going to be talking about today. And I should say, by way of preface, for those who might think that when I get started, that the best thing to do is to, even if you don't understand because I'm going so fast, by all means, stop, interrupt, flag, disagree. Let me know if I'm going too fast, because sometimes I get carried away and there's nothing sacred about having to finish this untouched. So I'm glad at any time to stop and explain what I'm doing with this. But to get back to the point, some books come along, as I say, every so often and help us. And one of these is the book which I have written on the board behind here, which I would like to endorse, and perhaps right now the hardcover edition is too expensive, and these books usually come out in paperback, but a very careful student of American religious life by the name of Daniel Yankelevich has put out a book simply entitled New Rules, and it's published by Random House, obviously 1981. And I would like to summarize Yankelevich's argument today, because I think he captures some trends and explain some movements that in a very perceptive way, and see some things that are happening. It isn't that I necessarily agree with them or disagree with them on some of these things, but I think he raises some questions and some issues that point to some of the trends which may bring some greater clarity and understanding to this very confusing world in which we live. And hence, I would like briefly to summarize Yankelevich's argument, and then see how you respond, what kind of questions, comments you have, and as always in Holden, and as we had in the Bible study, for instance, earlier this morning too, all topics really are open for discussion. There's no fixed agenda, and what comes to mind, what you think is important or useful for the group to discuss would certainly be welcome from me, because I don't personally have a message at the end. There's no little going along and along, and then suddenly at the end I've got a little summation myself. I'm a teacher, not a preacher, and although I preach once in a while, but still there's no sort of little moral at the end of this that that we're going to go through all this, and then after all the final answer is going to come up at the end. There's no final answer in some of these, because we're dealing with things which are very much in the immediate present with us. Now, who is Daniel Yankelevich? And why am I talking about him? Because I'm sure it's not a household name in your home back home, whereas some other people might be. Yankelevich may not be. He is a student of American social religious life who spends a great deal of time measuring attitudes and values through very, I think, carefully controlled opinion samples. So. He's gone beyond and refined many of the techniques and the methods used by people like George Gallup or the Roper people or some of the others. And what he has done is study very carefully over a long period of time, changing American social and religious attitudes so that he can come up with something more than just sort of educated guesses. What he has is a wide sampling of opinions and changing opinions over a long period of time. And from these, he can state with a good deal of assurance what really has happened. And about halfway through, I'll be going through some of his statistics here, because I think they are fascinating and they point to a certain convincing element in his argument, which otherwise might not be the case. I mean, it's one thing for people to sit down and write their opinions, and this may be very helpful, but it's something else when you've got these statistics. Just by way of one last statement about him, he got involved and is still involved in predicting presidential elections, and his methods became clearly superior to the others when in 1964, for instance, he came within one point of predicting how much Johnson would win over Goldwater. When you can come in, you know, within one tenth of one point, usually you give 3% error, one way or the other. When you can come in on, you know, without those kind of figures, you've obviously got something going for you. And he's been within 1 or 2 points of predicting the presidential elections ever since. He spotted all the various things, 68, 72, 76, of course, now in 1982. All right. Now, anyway, yes.
Did that Yankovic name come up somehow with Watergate?
No. Let's see, Watergate, somebody...
I better
let me turn on my press my computer button and get my Watergate tape and playing here. I can't. Well, there was Haldeman and there was Ehrlichman, you know, what you call the German shepherds. The two Germans who guarded Nixon, you remember? Who? I don't know. Anyway. Now, let me start with a quotation of his, and then go into his evidence, his case, and, you know, then our evaluation of this. He says this, and I quote him directly here: "Despite the elections," he means in 1980, the elections of that time. "Despite the elections, despite the pressures from the economy, the pressures for inflation and unemployment and all of this." And here's where he says something rather surprising. "I believe we are moving further and further away from a common rigid set of personal and social values. In other words, instead of a return, as some people interpreted the 1980 elections to be a return to older traditional kinds of values, such as we talked about so much in that particular election, he argues that we are moving further away from a common set of personal and social standards. Surveys and my own interviews," this is my speaking of Yankelevich, I'm quoting him now. Okay. "Surveys and my own interviews show a widening acceptance of cultural pluralism." Cultural pluralism is a big word for accepting a wide variety of different kinds of lifestyles and attitudes and positions, rather than simply holding to sort of an older position where there was simply one norm for work, one norm for family, one norm for social relations and politics and so on. Okay. "We are," to keep quoting him, "we are not going back to the old values." That's a key point. "We are not going back to the old values, to the notion that working hard, getting married, and having kids are the only acceptable life goals. We are not going back to that. We are not going back to the idea that people don't have the right to make their own choices about how they live and for what. In fact, the existence of the moral majority in a way shows the growing strength, not the weakness, of what I, Yankelevich, see as a cultural revolution in the progress. The moral majority people are counter-revolutionaries, yes, that is against the general culture of the time, and I think futilely so, to roll back what has already happened, as an example of this. In other words, he takes off from the 1980 election and says that it's not, in a sense, a reaffirmation of the older traditional values, such as we'll talk about the work ethic and so on, but we're moving into what he calls a cultural revolution. American life is moving us into wholly uncharted territory, not back to the lifestyles of the past. And here's where his evidence comes in. He argues we have a cultural revolution, really, and we see it in three different ways. Like a preacher, he has an introduction, 3 points, and a conclusion, obviously. So, what else? That's another story. Okay. "We have a cultural revolution." I don't have time for my bad jokes, since we have to have lunch at 11:50. Okay. With this. Three phases to the cultural revolution taking place at this time. First of all, the cultural revolution, he says, has great breadth. It encompasses most of American life. He said this isn't just the kind of cultural uprisings or changes we had in the 1960s, when we had, for instance, drastic changes taking place in the lives of the blacks, or drastic changes taking place in the life of campuses. We had the campus uprisings of the 1960s. Or some of the great uprisings or some of the great changes, for instance, in the ecology movement in the 1960s, like this. These were specialized single interest changes that took place in American life in the 1960s, and they really didn't, the 60s, for all of their change and noise and the good German word here, for all of their Sturm und Drang, or all their storm and stress, didn't really affect a wide variety of American people. But he argues the Cultural Revolution of the late 1970s and the early 1980s is, this revolution is encompassing the life of a great number of people. He argues from his statistics, and I'll go into this in detail later, that at least 80% of American people's lives, their cultural values, what they believe, what they hope for the future, have been touched and changed permanently because of the revolution that takes place. As he said, all of our public space is being touched by it, and not just the various movements of the 60s. All right. Now, this is what he means by the Cultural Revolution. What the Cultural Revolution, he argues, that is taking place is basically this, touching everybody. It's a search for a full, rich life, a search for a full, rich life, which is full of leisure, which is full of new experience and enjoyment as a replacement for the older traditional values. Many Americans, he argues, most Americans, have opted for a totally different kind of set of values and lifestyles which didn't exist before. It's a change or revolution away from the orderly, work-centered attitude of earlier days. The idea being that in the earlier days, one's primary responsibility was to one's work, one's job, one's family, and one's own life and leisure and expectations in as best one could live. As an example, and I think it's to illustrate this, I think it's a very good point. He uses some of the later movies of Woody Allen, especially Annie Hall, to show the conflict between, on the one hand, the desire for more personal self-fulfillment, for what I want for myself right here and now, on the one hand, versus the old tug to stay loyal to traditional values and hard work and thrift and loyalty to the nuclear family and all the rest of this. And he argues that Woody Allen in his movies, especially in Annie Hall, has captured this sort of tension very clearly. Allen himself is being torn between the two. And this shows up, I think, too, in the movie Manhattan, where he's being attracted towards the more interesting pleasures of the young girl rather than dedication to his work with this. Okay, on this. So the breadth, really, of the Cultural Revolution that he's talking about here discards many of the older traditional rules of personal conduct. The revolution he's talking about encourages greater tolerance. It permits more sexual freedoms. It puts less emphasis on work for its own sake. We have now, he argues, no longer, you know, strong loyalty to the old work ethic. I don't want to call it the Puritan work ethic, because that's usually what it's identified with, but there have been many, for instance, Jewish intellectuals who have looked at what was called the Puritan work ethic, and they say that looks like the Jewish work ethic to them too, Irving Kristol and some of the others. So we'll just call it the work ethic. That one's life is primarily a matter of working hard and doing your job and getting most of your fulfillment there, and family and leisure time and all of that sort of fit in as best they can after that. This, he argues, is being changed drastically. We have now not the old Puritan work ethic, but people who refuse to deny themselves anything because, quote, I have a duty for myself. And this is seen very clearly, for instance, in the so-called self-help movement. Looking out for number one, your erroneous zones, pulling your zones, pulling your own strings. This enormous emphasis on taking care of myself, what I want to do right here and now, somehow, hopefully, that, you know, everybody else will be doing the same things too. All sorts of examples of this. I have by way of illustration, I have a very unscientific sampling technique for this. I'm sure maybe it's gotten to the Pacific Northwest too, but it started with the Dayton Company in Minneapolis, the B. Belton Bookstore. So do they have those in Seattle, Portland, everything? All right. They started in Minneapolis. I've watched the number of merchandise aisles of self-help books and how they've grown in numbers. And they start, you know, with, you know, pulling your own strings, looking out for number one and so on. They've grown from about a half an aisle, merchandise island, to the last time I looked, about 2 weeks before I came here, 5.5 islands in Southdale, which is the big shopping center in South Minneapolis. Which is in South Minneapolis, is that great Lutheran womb of the North, as some of you know. So obviously some Lutherans are buying self-help books too. Otherwise, B. Dalton wouldn't put them in with us. Okay. So what we have is an enormous increase in this idea of self-help, of having a duty to oneself. And as I'm sure people could say, some people here would be able to give examples of what I'm talking about from their own rights. The old rules are gone. The old rules are passé, they're antiquated. People are willing to take more risks. And he gives a very interesting example here. He said, when things go wrong, for instance, such as people waking up and finding themselves with a flop of a marriage on their hand, they wake up and finding out how muddled their life choices have been. They find out that they've made a wrong-headed career change. But when this has happened to them, instead of sort of retreating back to the safety of older traditional values, that which seemed to have worked in the past, they don't do that any longer when they've had setbacks or discouragements or whatever it might be in life. Instead, they want to continue to experiment to find new ways through personal self-fulfillment as what is their due and what they're entitled to. All right, that's one characteristic of the Cultural Revolution. It encompasses a wide variety of people who aren't willing, even in times of crisis, personal crisis, to go back to the old ways, but they are willing to press out with it. All right. Secondly, he argues in the Cultural Revolution, this idea of personal self-fulfillment as the be-all and end-all of existence in America at this time, he finds a drastic mismatch, or he finds an inherent contradiction in it, which some people, he says, aren't willing really to concede with this. What he means by that is this. On the one hand, the people searching for self-fulfillment have certain specific goals in mind, what they want for themselves, in terms of their own life, in terms of their own pleasure, their use of leisure, time, money, recreation, all these different things. They have their goals in mind, but the means to achieve these goals, he argues, are contradictory to what they really want to achieve. The goals are one thing, but the means to achieve these are something else. All right, now, what does he mean by the mismatch, or in a real sense here, the contradiction? He said those caught up in the new self-help revolution want self-fulfillment. They have decided that life is more than sort of a grim economic chore where you have to get up in the morning and put in your 8 hours and come home again and flop in front of the tube and that's about it, and nothing more than this. So life is more than a grim economic chore. People just have decided they want more meaning, more self-expression, more adventure. And especially goaded on by the media, advertising and all the rest, they want more of the intangibles in life than they had before. They want more than simple job security. Before that seemed to, and take care of a lot of people. Some of you from the Depression can think back on, job security was just about enough at that particular time. And I'm not going to, I was going to go in with something else, but I'll stay with it. Sorry. They want the intangibles in life. They want, for instance, they want creativity. They want more leisure time. They want more pleasure, more community adventure. They want more vitality, more stimulation. That's a big order. All right. They, just as I said here, they are convinced the full meaning of life is not exhausted, you see, by earning a living, what you're bringing home, or doing one's duty, acting out the role society assigns to you, accepting your place in life, using and being used by others. He says these things have their place in life, but they are no longer dominant in the lives of so many Americans at this time. What the people caught up in the Cultural Revolution are talking about now is that life is to be enjoyed and cherished for its own sake, not just for what it does for society, for other people. Self-fulfillment by personal discovery, rather than anything else. All right, that's the basic goal, and if I repeat this, it's just because I want to be sure that it's clear. Now, where is the contradiction, where is the mismatch, according to Yankelevich here? If these are the goals, the intangibles, creativity, leisure, pleasure, adventure, vitality, stimulation, and all that, where then are the contradictions? He argues there are really two contradictions in terms of the means. First of all, the new self-fulfillment assumes that the economic security, which is necessary for this kind of life, is going to be guaranteed by the government. It's going to be guaranteed by the welfare state, such as we know it. And he argues this is not, a sound conclusion. This is really not an adequate conclusion to reach, because there's no guarantee that Americans are going to continue along with their economic well-being. As is evident now, there are significant numbers of people who are not going to be able to continue their present lifestyle with this. And therefore, for those who are seeking this life of personal fulfillment, they won't really be able to take for granted anymore the fact that their economic needs are going to be taken care of through the welfare state or the government in a broad sense of the word itself. Now, secondly, besides the economic mismatch or contradiction in their argument, secondly is what he calls a psychological contradiction. And this is the fact that those caught up in pursuing personal self-fulfillment as the chief and primary and perhaps only goal in life will discover at a certain point, and this will be his conclusion as we'll see a little bit later, that once they have in a sense met these needs, they really aren't any better off psychologically or in terms of their own feeling than they had been before. Say a person becomes autonomous, say a person has developed some of the, or has achieved some of the goals which they set out for themselves as personal self-fulfillment. They know how to pull their own strings. They know how to look out for number one. Suddenly what they find is that their lives are no, you know, richer or fuller now than they were before, because and then I'll save the answer for that later on, because then he'll come in with his reason why looking out for number one and pulling one's own strings really doesn't work that way.
Another aspect of that contradiction is that they assume a static thing that you can reach this goal and then you'll be happy ever after.
But once you get these things, once you've got let's say personal possessions. I lived for a while in the new ultimate suburb of the Twin Cities. It's no longer Edina. We used to have a lot of fun with Edina and so on, but it's now Burnsville as the status place to live. It's just unbelievable what's happened in Burnsville. And anybody from Burnsville here? I'd be glad to talk about it. So when I watched it up close for a while, and just and this is what's happening there, and the emotional stress that's a result of living in Burnsville is enormous. I'm sure this is true in Seattle and Portland. You can name your own suburbs getting there, and that once you've got your house in Burnsville and you've got your mortgage and your, what is it, whatever, 12% mortgage, and you've got your house and your mortgage, and now they've got four car garages. I was ready for two, except now there are four car garages. It's just normal. In the new housing sections, the Orrin Thompson housing developments in Burnsville so we've got the second characteristic is that it aims at certain kinds of personal self-fulfillment, but the means probably are contradictory, depending on continuing economic well-being and continuing on the idea that Emily talked about here. And underline again that once these are achieved, that there will no longer be the kind of challenges or the appetites really necessary for this. And third, the third characteristic of the movement is what he calls his label, the stakes are high. That this is not just a sort of normal, predictable, ordinary kind of change in American society, but that most of the older traditional values and goals which Americans have cherished and have upheld for a long period of time really are on the line right now. That we are at something of a turning point. Now, I know it's always authors are saying that we're always at a turning point. And this is always a good way to sell a book, is by saying we're at a turning point. And I grant you that, but I'm not really that cynical about this particular book, because I think he's got a good deal of evidence, which I want to go into here in a little bit of time. All right. What he argues is this, to use his expressions, what the personal self-fulfillment revolution is doing is trying to ignore the older idea that he likes, that life is basically, the needs of life are basically best met when what he calls the sacred and the giving aspects of life are recognized and implemented themselves. He sees the contest, in other words, as a struggle between those caught up in the battle for personal self-fulfillment on the one hand versus the obvious to him point that the way in which a rich and full life is actually met is through a recognition of what he calls, and I'll define these later, what he calls the sacred and the giving elements of life rather than the purely self-centered or the utilitarian forms of life. With this, he sees, to put it this way, this by way of illustration here, it's the old familiar idea in America. We've become enormously proficient in producing goods and services. We can crank out new products, we can crank out new, exciting goods for people to buy with the promise, you know, that this will help bring the good life. I mean, all the advertisements, you know, tell us this. You're not far from a Buick and move up to an Oldsmobile and find happiness by moving out to Shoddy Acres, housing out in Brooklyn Park, or I should have said Shady Acres. No, it was deliberate by saying Shoddy Acres, but anyway, this sort of thing. And he argues that since there is so much enormous progress, you see, in producing certain goods and products in American life, we seem to think that our lives should be just as enriching as the goods and the products which are available to us. Now we've got, for instance, things where we can record television programs for 2 weeks. You can go away, and for some of you who came here, if you bought the right thing for, what is it, about $1,000, you can get, just by pushing a few buttons, every one of the shows you missed. I don't know if every one, it depends on how much you watch television, but you can get about 6 hours or 10 hours, I don't know how many it is, of shows that you missed over these 2 weeks.
Yeah, but if you do that, you'll never catch up.
Yeah, it depends on, you know, how late you stay up at night. If you stay up and sleep, I mean, watch TV all night, which I think some people do, you can catch up on these things. But this is what I mean, that suddenly we are given all these new products and we expect our lives to be the richer for them, and he argues that it really isn't necessary, it isn't necessarily going to work out that way. So we find frustration. We find real frustration. On the one hand, to summarize again, we want self-fulfillment here. We want a career. We want a marriage. We want children. We want autonomy. We want to have money. We want to be, in a sense, nonconformist. We want to have social justice. We want to enjoy city life, yet we want to enjoy country life. We want to have simplicity, yet we want to have sort of gracious living. We want to have time for our individual needs, yet we want to have friends, and so on down the line. All these different demands and pressures that were being put on us. Now, the problem, according to Yankelevich here, is that we have confused needs and desires. We have really mixed up needs and desires in all these things which the manufacturers and the media tell us, you know, we have to have. Most of what we think are needs really are desires, according to him. Coming out of an earlier period of time of greater economic austerity, such as we had in the 1930s, for instance, we have now got to the point where desires have really, to some people, become needs. And since our desires aren't being fulfilled, which we think are needs, a certain kind of frustration sets in. We're with this, and that we have got to the point where when we see suppression of our desires, we decide that it really isn't our own appetites that are to blame, but it is something out there, somewhere, someplace, that is at work, and we can sort of make our lives better if we can find the right formula to be able to come to terms with this. Americans are tremendously fond, I think more than probably any other nation, of step-by-step formulas, for successful living. This really goes way back, by way of illustration, I think, to Ben Franklin. Name everybody here knows. Franklin decided that if he couldn't be perfect morally, he could come awfully close. So he decided there were 12 virtues. I don't know how many sins he's decided, but he's decided there were 12 virtues, and that he would cultivate one virtue exclusively each week. And by the time he was done at the end of the 12-week period, he would have his life about as morally perfect as possible. What happened is that, say, he practiced thrift for a week, and then he would practice courtesy or whatever it might be, but by the time he got to the end of the 12 weeks, you know, the bottom had fallen out at the other end again. And he would have to start all over again with us. He might have been very thrifty the first week, but by about week 8, the thrift was beginning to slip a little, while kindness or humor or something else was doing this. And this has picked up with, you know, has continued in American life. You become a successful salesman, for instance, by following certain steps. Dale Carnegie's techniques started in the 1920s with us. Or my favorite of all, the high priest of positive thinking, Norman Vincent Peale, who has 4 steps to do this or 6 steps to do that. And therefore, once you've done these, you should achieve the good life with us. And what Yankelevich has found is that Americans have accepted this idea and won't admit to the fact that the good life which they want, the personal self-fulfillment which they want, isn't really working. And he says this is the case, and this is sort of a transition now in his argument into the more positive side of it, besides the indictment which he makes of this Cultural Revolution. He argues that what has gone wrong is this, that we have ignored what he calls the giving and getting compact. I want to be go into this in some detail because I think it's so helpful. He said we've got this sort of sense of frustration or sense of stalemate because of the fact that we've ignored what he calls the giving, you know, slash getting compact. Now, what does he mean by the getting compact? Giving, G-I-V-I-N-G. I know I'm not enunciating well here. Giving and getting compact. Okay. I'm just using his terms. Now, what does he mean by the giving slash getting compact? Okay. He means those unwritten rules which govern what we give in our life. Those unwritten rules which we give in our life. Those things we do in our marriage, in our work, in our community. What we do to sacrifice for others, and at the same time, what we expect in return. When we give, for instance, in our marriage, in our work, in our community, we expect certain things in return. This is, you know, the giving, getting compact. Now, this compact is rarely, you know, spelled out. I know some people, for instance, recently have made marriage contracts, which kind of, I shudder from those things. Who's going to take out the garbage on Thursday, for instance, and so on, and who's going to do the shopping, and so on. My own idea there is that if two people have to make a contract before they get started and write it down in legal form, they're going to have lots more discussion later on. We take this giving, getting contract so much for granted, we don't get excited about it until we see a change. And what he argues is happening is that the giving, getting contract is changing right now. And it's changing drastically because the personal self-fulfillment people caught up in this revolution are making new demands on the giving, getting compact. All right, let me rephrase it in a little different way. Let's pretend now that I'm a person looking at the world, looking at America and what's happening, and I'm saying this about myself and what I want. He said, I give hard work. I am a loyal person. I am steadfast. I swallow my frustrations. I suppress my impulses to do what I would enjoy, and I do instead what's expected of me. I don't put myself first. I put the needs of others ahead of me. I give a lot, but what I get in return is worth it. I receive an ever-growing standard of living and family life with a devoted spouse and decent kids. Our children will take care of us in our old age. I have a nice home, a good job, respect of friends and neighbors, a sense of accomplishment, of having made something of my life, and I am proud of being an American. Now, he argues, this is the point, he argues that that compact, those values were predominant in this country until about the middle to late 1970s. But the revolution has come and that these traditional values, this giving-getting compact, is no longer in force in the degree to which it had been before. There have been significant changes that have taken place until in the last few years. Now he argues tens of millions, to use his exact figure, tens of millions of Americans have grown tired of sacrifice. They want to modify the old giving-getting compact in one or more of the of its dimensions, in its family life, in career, in leisure, the meaning of success, relationships with others, relationships with themselves. Now, to be concrete, and these are the statistics which he gives, which I want to go through here in some detail, to prove his case that the old giving-getting compact is broken down, he goes through attitude changes, value changes, what he has found in American life over a long period of, over the last 40 years. All right, and I'll go through some statistics, and I won't go through the exact ones unless you want me to. I've got all the, is Clarence still looking for the ball game? Is that who this is here? Okay, anyway, if Laurie can do a joke, I can pick up on it and tell you too. All right, with this, all right. Now, what have the changes been? He said, for instance, here has been a major, I'll have about 10 or 12 of these. In 1938, just to go back, there were something like 75% of the American people showed disapproval of a married woman earning money if she had a husband capable of earning a good life for the family. That attitude has shifted down from 75% to about 20% today, which is a drastic change in public opinion. The idea that a woman should work, even should work or can be able to work, even though the husband makes enough for everybody. In 1945, this was the ideal. Four or more children is the ideal number for a family. In 1945, that has gone down by 1980 to 15% as the ideal. Now in 1980, two children is the ideal for over 65% of the American people. drastic change that's taken place here. Now, here's a fascinating one for me. In 1957, as late as 57, 80% of the American public thought, for quote, for a woman to remain unmarried, she must be sick, neurotic, or immoral. 80% of the American people thought this in 1957, that an unmarried woman was sick, neurotic, or immoral. And Mr. Wright was out there, you know, and just waiting, you know. And I remember once we had a discussion of this right here, and a woman about 50 who was single said that for a long time she used, the way she used to explain this to herself was that she was an unclaimed gem. And that there were all kinds of prospectors out, but they just hadn't found this unclaimed gem. It was the prospector's fault, not her fault. You see, she was a real gem. And then she said, you know, I'm not kidding myself any longer with this. But that's a nice way of putting it. That's a tremendous change that's taken place in American life. From 80% to just over 25% of Americans have changed their attitude on that. All right. Or another one, still with the whole idea of reversal of sex roles here. In 1937, 25% of the American public said they would vote for a woman for the presidency. By 1980, this had gone up to 78%. From 25% to 78% of Americans said that they would now vote for a qualified woman nominee for the presidency with this. In 1967, over 90% of the American public condemned premarital sex as morally wrong. In 1979, that had shrunk from 90% down to 35% as another attitude change with this. The same thing, I'll just read these off, I don't want to go through the statistics. There's been a drastic change in the attitude that both parents have responsibilities for caring for small children with this. So there has been a drastic decline in the idea that hard work always pays off, especially among young people. I'll give you an illustration from my own life. My father's advice to me when he sent me out into the world was that there's always room at the top for one more good one. And I believed it. I really did. You know, another hard work, thrift, there's a slogan in Minneapolis Bank, tuck a buck a day away, and so on. Hard work, thrift, and all these things would inevitably pay off. And the good jobs are out there, and if you didn't get the good job, it was your fault. And I believed. I'll give one other example. We had our high school commencement speaker in his illustration, 1948. His illustration was that life is like a farmer taking a load of apples to market. And there were a lot of bumps and curves and dips and ups and downs and rocks and different things. And there was a lot of shaking going on in this journey of the apples to market. And at the end, when we got to market, the big juicy red ones were right up on top where they belong, and the little runty, wormy ones were right down on the bottom where they belong. And everybody cheered and thought this was tremendously profound. And it sort of stayed with me all the time. That idea has shrunk enormously at this time. Well, they could go on and on with changes with attitudes here, interracial marriage being wrong, cohabitation, you know, all kinds of different attitudes that have changed in our particular life. All right. So by way of summation then, and what Yankelevich wants to get at, he argues that what is clear with these change of attitudes is that the evidence now becomes convincing that personal self-fulfillment, such as so many people are pursuing, is simply no longer an adequate kind of way to cope with the world as we understand it now. He argues instead, and here he becomes the preacher here instead of the teacher. He says, we know that the path taken by the inner journey, that is, of personal self-fulfillment, must now point outward rather than purely inward. Must now point outward rather than inward. And here he becomes something of a prophet rather than simply as a collector and analyzer of social statistics. He becomes something of a prophet, somebody preaching here and looking at the future. He says that there are scraps and shreds of evidence that a new social ethic in America is emerging, a new ethic of commitment, one away from self-fulfillment. He finds what he calls a poignant yearning to express the sacred in the giving aspects of life and to diminish the self-fulfillment aspects of life. He says, and this is what might make his book a major statement, the first signs of breaking away from personal self-fulfillment and towards greater giving, towards greater recognition of the sacred dimension of life are appearing. Now, he finds these in two specific places. First of all, there is a much greater concern and awareness of the need for deeper and more permanent personal relationships with us. As one example, and here he quotes Christopher Lash's book, and I'll mention this just briefly and then go on to explain what he means by this. Lash, in 1978, came out with a very penetrating study called The Culture of Narcissism, in which he documented this idea that I've talked about before of personal self-fulfillment, and did this and showed some of the results from this. And I've got some tapes, if you want to play these, where we did this in the winter of 1980 out here. We had long sessions going on. The one advantage of the winter session out here is that you have time at night, and if you get going on something, you can go on and on and on, as we did with us. All right. But Lash saw in 1978 clearly this yearning for deeper, more permanent personal relationships than had been the case before. And some of the difficulty here, and maybe this will touch on the lives of some of you, is that given the nature of the American economy, so many people are transferred by their company for whom they work oftentimes, and they're simply couldn't put down roots. And I don't know how many times I've heard in here people who had to make the choice between being transferred from Seattle to Denver, let's say, and pulling up the roots and the children's friendships and all the rest of these things, where you get a better job in Denver, get a better pay, or else staying in Seattle or Minneapolis, wherever it might be, where your friends are and where your roots are and where you want to believe, creating enormous kinds of tensions for all kinds of people. And I'm sure many of you could give examples from your own life here. But he sees the need, you see, for deeper personal relationships and the desire for more friendship. And here we have a book in the bookstore I'd like to endorse. Last year, Martin Marty brought out a book simply entitled Friendship, and he has good, solid documentary evidence for this. To back up what Yankelevich is saying here, that most Americans admit they have few close personal friends and consider this to be something of a serious void in their lives. And that an increasing number of people are willing to make some kinds of sacrifices, like a promotion, a better job, whatever it might be, in order to hold on to certain kinds of friendships, which wouldn't have been the case before, because the old American idea, you know, was always what we call upward mobility. So long as you were getting promoted and moving up the path, you were a success. But some people are arguing now that that kind of success is too high a price to pay for this. All right. So as one example of changing attitudes and a resistance to the personal self-fulfillment kind of revolution, he sees the desire for greater friendships with us. A second dimension to this is what he calls the appearance of greater concern for the sacred and the giving values in our lives. Now, what does that mean? He finds a new willingness to sacrifice material rewards in life appearing. The whole movement towards simpler lifestyle, towards reducing consumption, towards giving up status, for instance, as the most important thing in life, and having much greater concern for the care of this planet, for the care of the land, the plants, the mountains, the oceans, for instance. The whole ecology movement, the respect for nature movement, is a recognition of what he would call the giving or the sacred dimension to life itself with us. And what he finds coming out of this, you see, is a new understanding of the rewards and benefits of the life of living in community with others, the life of sharing rather than the life simply of consuming itself with us. In other words, to finish here, and then we'll go into the discussion, he sees some signs that Americans are growing less absorbed with themselves and are prepared to take the first steps towards commitment. But he says the danger is that once this sort of decision to change one's values away from personal self-fulfillment and towards the giving sacred element of life are going to run into some very real problems. For instance, there's going to be the problems of conflict over employment. More and more young people coming on the job market versus older people who want to hold on to their jobs. It's a very real kind of problem. It's going to frustrate a lot of people. And this is seen, for instance, in the whole battle over, you know, the age for Social Security retirement right now, as an example of what might be done. There is going to be continuing battles over the whole pro-life, pro-choice debate in America. There's going to be all kinds of problems over where to place the tax burdens. there's going to be all kinds of problems over, you know, criminal justice, all kinds of problems over the place of the media, all kinds of problems over racism and sexism. And certainly, as an example of this, racism in our country has increased. And what he means by listing these problems that we're all familiar with, is what if there's a possibility and the danger, he says here, that when people see some of these new problems appearing, even though they may have decided to opt for greater, you know, loyalty to friendships and to the sacred expressive areas of life, they will retreat in light of these enormous problems that we're facing back into the older traditional thing of saying, well, I can't do anything about the economy, I can't do anything about racism or sexism or the job market or anything else, therefore the only thing I can do, you see, is take care of myself. The only thing I can do is look out for number one. And he finds this to be the greatest trap, you see, the greatest danger of all, because what happens then is that people become fatalistic. And he thinks, and we can debate this too, he thinks this accounts for the growing popularity among certain people that the world is soon coming to an end. And that since the world is soon coming to an end, as Hal Lindsey has told us now in his fifth book, I have a theory about that I can talk about later. Since the world is coming to an end, there isn't really, you don't have to be premillennial to believe that. You don't have to be, quote, religious-minded to believe this. You can simply believe as, say, Henry Adams believed, the famous American historians, or Oswald Spengler believed, that the world is simply running out of everything, and that pretty soon there just isn't going to be anything. The world will end with a whimper, not a bang, and so on. That since people believe this, then, you know, what's that old Peggy Lee song? Then the only thing to do is bring out the booze and let's start the dancing, as an example for this. Or else you can believe that indeed the world is coming to an end and that there's not much you can do. And I like what Martin Marty, I wish I'd made the quip, but he did. But Martin Marty said about Hal Lindsey, he said that Hal Lindsey gave up on the world before God did. And God is still around, but Hal Lindsey isn't so sure any longer of this. And therefore, what Yankelevich calls for is some way of nurturing the ideas of enhancing the respect for the sacred giving elements of life in a time of a cultural revolution when he thinks American life could go, you know, one way or the other. And with that in mind, and with a half an hour or so, we've got time for comments. Yeah.
When you were talking about ladder of self-fulfillment and achievement, mm-hmm. and the change now to more emphasis on friendship. I'm thinking of reading Magic Fox's book on compassion. You talked about Sarah's circle, that concept of you're more concerned with.
Yeah, the circle where everybody is equal, for one thing, and everybody is interrelated, as an example of this. I think that's a hopeful sign of the this kind of recognition.
Another new sign is Alan Alda's new movie, Four Seasons, where he deals with friendship.
Yeah,
how it goes into the superficial to the depth of friendship.
But I think that's an interesting thing. I got up here where there were no movies before I had a chance to see it, but I've heard that that's worth seeing. Alan Alda's movie, what is it?
Four Seasons.
Four Seasons, right? Yeah, he's the one with MASH. Yeah,
he thinks that this revolution, he calls it, is unique to America, or do you think it's worldwide?
No, primarily with America and to some other of the industrial nations, but in America, it's more prevalent than other countries because Americans have had higher, and I didn't go into this before, Americans have had higher expectations and demands of life, or I should say expectations of the good life than other countries have had. We were promised life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, and no other country has ever made that audacious a kind of set of promises. And because that's promising a whole lot. He sees, as Douglas John Hall does in his book The Light in Our Darkness, that the great frustration in American life has been, on the one hand, being taught and brought up with the American dream of expecting these things to happen, and then, you know, the realities of not finding them themselves, of appearing in their lives, and then putting the blame, you know, somewhere else, or else giving up completely and getting into the hedonistic ethic altogether. You know, bring on the booze and let's start the dancing. But I'm giving a Hubert Humphrey kind of answer to your question here. But I listened to Hubert since 1948, and you know, after, you get to give long, convoluted answers to simple questions. he limits it primarily to America, right? But it is possible in other countries too. I could give one example here. We spent where some of the dangers and the backlash of this comes early. We were 4 months in northern Thailand in the St. Olaf program, and there was one little simple tribal village, and life was going along fairly well, and suddenly television comes along. And in order to, some of the people had been to Chiang Mai, which is where we were, and had seen from the village and had seen the television, and they really liked it. And I mean, wonderful shows like Kojak and Charlie's Angels and Three Stooges. I mean, these are the American shows that were shown there, not Alistair Cook or some of the others. And they wanted it. And but to get television in this little this little town, Sukhothai, they would have to have electricity, and they didn't have electricity. So they got electricity, and they found that when they got electricity, they could not only have television, but they could have electric lights. And when they got electric lights, they got mosquitoes. And Thai buildings are set up for subtropical climates. And there's no way in which you can put on screens in a northern Thai village. And so they sit there slapping mosquitoes and watching Kojak at the same time. And a few of them are beginning to wonder if the price is worth it. That I remember seeing that. It was so vivid. Some of them just couldn't handle mosquitoes. Yeah. Larry.
Speaking of television, that reminded me of a little book that Mary carries in the bookstore. I think she still has copies of John Taylor's book, Enough is Enough. She says in there that when you sit in front of your television set and see the advertisements, you should always ask the question, who are you kidding?
Yeah.
When the promise is that by purchasing this, you'll experience some self-fulfillment, because the whole purpose of advertising is to create perpetual dissatisfaction.
Right.
Yep. If you do not get perpetual dissatisfaction, you don't have people coming back buying the next version. So, so we should always ask the question, who are you trying to kid?
And that's what feeds the idea of personal self-fulfillment as being, you know, the right of everybody. You look at, for instance, I had some of the Slick magazines, and they project a way of life which is totally consumptionist and has none of the responsibilities. I mean, cars, you know, good liquor, clothes, all of these things, and you know, none of the way the world really is. Yeah.
On the advertising, Richard Barnett did an interesting study of advertising over a stretch of time. He compared a long time ago, I think, the turn of the century and advertisements now. And the striking difference between the two is that the early set of advertisements, primary communication there was to convey information about this. It would tell you what's in it, what it's made of, you know, how long you're expected to last, etc. Whereas the advertisements today tell you almost nothing whatsoever about what you're purchasing, but it's the communication is purchased.
To get the name of the label, the product in your head. I'm trying to think of one right offhand, but I don't want to. I want to go on with Ron.
Well, there's a magazine I discovered in the reading room and also in the library called Communities. It had a very interesting article about some agricultural economists that went to China to see how they were doing things in China. The Chinese people couldn't understand why they would want to even study what they were doing in China. They were proud of what they did, but they were eager to move on, and they wanted to hear what was going on in the United States. And for a more responsible use of resources and everything, the agricultural economists were really impressed that the Chinese they see them as going through a period that they think may be very, very desirable, and they just couldn't really communicate.
Yeah, that is interesting, right? In the back, yeah.
Yes, I was wondering, you had mentioned in your statistics about how things have changed about feeling towards singles and about the correct family size and so on. Was there any mention about divorce in there, how that has risen and so on?
He doesn't have a statistic on that as such. But clearly, the change to what we call no-fault divorce is a clear example of this. I suppose almost every state has no-fault divorce now, if I'm not mistaken. Wouldn't that be a fair assumption? That you don't have to prove guilt or malfeasance or something with this if you plead irreparable breakdown, and you don't have to do what they used to do in New York For instance, infidelity was considered for a long time the only grounds for divorce, so you can imagine the good business that private detectives did, chasing after people, having liaisons in the afternoon, for instance, and the degrading aspect that comes with this. Yeah, that would be a clearer example of changing attitudes, yeah.
Well, the reason I was asking, I'm not from Burnsville, but you mentioned about the vice yeah. And I taught there for 9 years, and every year, my class size varies, but the last one I had was about 23, and every year, the children coming from divorced families has risen.
Yeah. Yeah, there are some statistics in the Seattle Times this week on that.
It's 1-to-1.
Is it 1-to-1 now?
Yeah. So it is in Seattle.
In Seattle.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. But I would think that it's probably not fair for me to say that it's risen there only because I know that it's
now there, you know, a lot of different ways to interpret those statistics. One came in California when California was the first state to put in the no-fault divorce law. And what it shows was there was a tremendous surge or an upsurge of the number of divorces in California right away, and then it went down, which means most likely that there were a whole lot of unhappy marriages which wouldn't have been able to have been ended had it not been for the easier no-fault laws at the time. Because there was this big peak, just like a stock market chart, and then down again. I think that's the best way of interpreting that. Other comments, questions, disagreements?
Just
wisdom.
A comment, then I'll
sure.
Just a historical note. Karl Marx said that the characteristic of the bourgeoisie was self-absorption.
Yeah.
And that it would increasingly bring about the atomization of society, and that at some point it would not be able to, the economy would not be able to sustain the kind of breakdown that takes place in the relationship with the self-absorbing.
Yeah, and Jan Kelevich may maybe think something of the same thing, that people becoming so preoccupied with their own, what they think are their basic needs, which are really desires, that they can't sustain the sense of community that's going to be necessary. For instance, just with something we talk about a great deal here at Holden, of the allocation and the use of natural resources, which in many cases are running out. What is it? 6% of the American, I mean, America has 6% of the world's population, and we use over 30% of the world's resources. As John says so often, the world can't afford America much longer, the way it's being used up. But I'll let John speak for himself on that, which...
I think it's kind of interesting. People as a whole, I think, in our country today, they don't realize why the American dream isn't working. So this I think, is one of the main reasons why we have the large number of divorces and the increase in divorce. They think that, well, doing your own thing and so forth, that the first thing that comes to mind is that it must be your partner's fault or something, why you're not... Even though you have the four-car garage in this beautiful suburb, that you're still unhappy, you see. So sometimes it takes a while.
Yeah, yeah. Jim?
One of my favorite historians is the Englishman A.J.P. Taylor.
Okay.
Number one, he's for a little England rather than the British Empire. He's happy that England lost all that. Number two, he's not a pessimist. He said that British historians started writing about the decline of the West when they lost their personal maids and had to wash their own dishes.
That's cute. Yeah, that's cute. I like that. And England would be a good example of the decline here that's taken place. Yeah.
You know, Sir Thomas More talked about this in 1450, I think it was.
The trend started then.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Does Jan Kelevich end up with a pessimistic or an optimistic?
Well, he argued it's sort of a challenge. Unless we go back to the sacred giving kinds of values, recognition of these, he feels that the hedonism will simply wipe America out as, not instantly or something like that, but will go into a tailspin, and America will simply become a second or third rate power, and that the divisions between the rich and the poor, between the races, the classes, and all the rest, will get worse rather than better.
Is he saying we have to go back to this, or is he talking about going forward?
Something new. Right? You can't go back. He argues you can't go back to older traditional work ethic. That simply is out. We have to recognize that a lot of young people today aren't really enchanted with the prospects that they have for them. We have a large number of people who spend $20,000 getting a BA from a good college, and they may well, considering their first job, they may well not be able to get what they would like any longer. But, and this is a real reversal. When I got out of graduate school, I had 5 jobs offered me. And now, what is it, 1 or 2% of those who have PhDs can count on getting jobs in any given year. And so there's a great deal of disenchantment among the younger people towards some of the older, toward the, I think the old work ethic among the young people is pretty well gone, myself.
Well, it'd be a question of whether you wanted to go back to it anyway.
Yeah.
Because there's a direct tie between the success of the work ethic and the transition to the consumption ethic.
Yeah.
I mean, Cotton Mather said, religion gave birth to prosperity and then the daughter swallowed the mother.
Yeah.
Where did you repeat
John, that? John Wesley just wrestled with this. He said, you have to tell all the Christians to work hard and be diligent and not spend their money, but in the process they'll all get rich.
Yeah, and they can't.
So then in order to keep the whole society going, you've got to consume.
Yeah, yeah.
And so there's a real question of whether the work ethic, when it's successful, doesn't undermine itself.
Yes. Jim?
One study that I enjoyed years ago, because I've always been sort of pro-union and belonged to unions and had union jobs in there with all the defects, which I assure you I know. Somebody made a study of Samuel Gompers. He was the best cigar roller that ever came out of Romania. And Walter Ruther and Victor Ruther are two of my sort of halfway heroes. They traveled around the world. They were such wonderful machinists that in Russia they got a job immediately and worked in Russian machine shops. And wherever they went, they were the top craftsmen. And then they came back to America, and you know what they did in Detroit? 1937.
Yeah.
The early, I don't think George Meany was much of a plumber, but that's another problem. But the curious fact about union leaders who are famous for feather bedding is their early leadership were as disciplined as Benjamin Franklin or anyone else for hard work. Young people now are cynical about the unions, but they certainly go for some of the easygoing ways that unions brought to factories. They just skip the step of the Gompers and the Walter Ruther, and they when I worked with them in various activities, they certainly liked the easygoing life and the early quits.
Yeah, the I've heard the argument, and somebody disagree with me, if that one reason there are more, say, defective automobiles, for instance, or defects in major appliances, is that there isn't a sort of dedication to work and quality, especially in the younger people, than you find in the older ones.
I found something really amazing to me in this Communities magazine, which I just discovered. There is a co-op in Spain, in northern Spain, that was started by a priest some years ago. That has 20,000 members. I'm writing to get more information on it. Evidently, they all are equal, and they're the leading producers of refrigerators, furniture, and I believe cement in all of Spain. With 100%, every business that they've ever started has been successful, and they're growing at the rate of 30%. So
they must be doing something right.
Yeah, this is fantastic. I can't understand how this
goes. Yeah, in the back here.
There's a lot of talk about productivity.
Yeah.
That's what you're talking about.
Yeah.
And a lot of talk that the shoddy merchandise is a result of that attitude of the working man.
Yeah.
But there's quite a bit of thought that the problem is top management and how they deal with people. And the Japanese have come over here and taken over plants and using their style of dealing with people and increased productivity considerably, which I think indicts the top management, the hierarchy, for the lack of Sarah Circle. And then the co-op you're talking about is more the Sarah Circle.
Yep.
And that's where the fulfillment comes in.
Yep.
One of the revolutions that could be coming, is dealing with people down the road.
Yep. That I've heard examples, and some of you could give examples yourself too, where in a plant they divide people into work teams of 20 and let the team itself decide how to take care of the problem, rather than having a table of organization in which one person gets to do just one job. So you have a much greater sense of personal involvement and personal pride in what you're doing.
That's
I like that idea.
In Sweden, though.
Yeah.
I tried it in the Volvo plants in Sweden, and the folks just said, no, we don't want to make all the decisions.
Oh, really?
We're only put in our 8 hours, and then we'll have our, get our check, and we've got our leisure time, and they were living for their leisure time.
Yeah. That to me is an unbelievable problem that I just can't imagine a satisfactory or a long-range satisfactory way out of with this, but it's with us, yeah.
I'm just wondering about the kind of hope
future any kind of optimism. And I'm wondering if it might be that the promise that the meek shall inherit the earth, and looking at the biblical story of how, you know, in the Old Testament, when the people became complacent and self-absorbed and all of that sort of thing, and the prophets would come along and they wouldn't listen to them, and you know, there was, you could see how discouraged someone like Jeremiah could get, you know, and just nothing was going to happen. And finally then the whole nation just fell apart and went into exile. And when they were in exile, then they saw, you know, their need for God, and somehow there was a renewal and a rejuvenation of life, and kind of a scary type of thing to think that, you know, the nation can't fall apart. And maybe if that's true, that the meek shall inherit the earth, that's kind of some hope or some
problem. On that note of hope, maybe we should get ready for lunch, who comes at 11:50.